2 Samuel, we are attempting to cover chapters 19, 20, and 21, and also verses 8 through 39 of chapter 23. That's a large section, but it's just a big list of names, so it's not like we're adding a whole lot to it, and you'll see why. So let's begin with chapter 19, the first portion, verses 1 through 15. 2 Samuel chapter 19, verses 1 through 15. We learned last week about the revolt of Absalom against his father David, and how with Absalom's death by Joab, the revolt also dies a natural death, him being the instigator of the whole revolt. However, David's time of mourning and grief for his son Absalom was much too long. We covered these terms last week also, you may recall, in that his fatherhood overshadows the responsibilities of kingship. David's fatherhood overshadows his responsibilities of kingship, and his time of grief and mourning is much too long. And this was a bad mistake, because David, his whole army, all his men, all his soldiers, they, in all natural rights, wanted to have a victory celebration. And here was David, the king, mourning and mourning for Absalom, my son Absalom. And so David needed to affirm the loyal soldiers of his, as also to make an attempt to win back those defectors who had joined with Absalom in the revolt. And instead he was mourning over Absalom. And it was a rather tricky situation, because he needed to affirm his men, his soldiers, and he needed to also be able to coax or cajole those who had joined in the revolt with Absalom without offending either party. But he is so carried away mourning for Absalom, Joab comes to him in verses 5 through 7. Joab really lets David have it. He says, it says, and Joab came to the house of the king and said, "You've shamed today the faces of all your servants who saved your life, the lives of your sons and daughters, wives and concubines, in that you love your enemies and hate your friends, because you have declared today that you regard neither princes nor servants." In other words, you are ignoring your whole army that fought and risked their lives for you. "For today I understand and perceive that if Absalom had lived," 7b, "if Absalom had lived and all of us had died, then you would have been very pleased. So you're showing us that you love your enemies and you hate your friends." And Joab was rather blunt and crude, but David needed to be jolted back to reality, and Joab was bold enough to do that for him. That was verse 6b, where he says, "If Absalom had lived and all of us had died, you would have been well pleased." Here's three of the factions David had to deal with. One, his own men, his own soldiers and army. He needed to show them proper respect and show his appreciation. We are focusing on leadership. A leader needs to show his appreciation for those who serve him. It would have been perfectly in order for them to have a victory celebration, but they couldn't, for the king sitting there mourning. A good leader must never forget to show his appreciation. And what's the second half? Nor overlook the value of ceremony. And I've seen good instances of good leadership in Lancaster County companies with employees I've heard reports from. Down the street from us, a company, the boss, every Thanksgiving, every employee gets a huge Thanksgiving turkey when they go to pick up their paychecks. Good leaders must not forget to show appreciation to those who serve them, nor overlook the value of ceremony. Now here's the other end of being extremely overly kind. One company in the county I know, every year, like I believe it was last year, they sent all their employees on a paid vacation to Acapulco, Mexico. I'm not sure how many days. But really, if bosses look out for good deals on charters, it could come to something like $250 per employee. And so it's not that much when you get a good charter deal once a year. And those, we never heard about this by radio advertisement or by television, but the employees themselves and their spouses speak this up, or, and it flies around town. And so a good leader must never forget to show his appreciation, nor overlook the value of ceremony. And when we say ceremony, at special times of year, I mentioned Thanksgiving, be it Christmas, vacation time, whenever. No good leader takes his supporters for granted. Even David, as good and strong and anointed he was, he could not afford to take his supporters for granted. In fact, Joab went on to tell him, if you don't go out now and sit by the gate and encourage the troops, I swear to you, said Joab, that they will be gone, there will be a revolt on your hands, and your situation will be worse than it was under Absalom or at any time before in your life. And David could not afford to take his loyal supporters for granted. Neither can any good leader today. Somebody has made a statement that hate is cousin to love. And if that be true, then loyalty and revolt could not have been very far apart, because David's most loyal soldiers would have revolted and left him had he continued to ignore them for their service to him. And then the second faction, we just dealt with his army. The second faction he needed to deal with was the people. Even they couldn't rejoice in the victory. Plus, many of them had sided with Absalom. However, in the case of the people in this instant, with Absalom now being dead, the instigator of the revolt being dead, he was best forgotten, and most often the common people are that way, and then common sense begins to assert itself, and gradually the people start to turn their hearts back towards David. And the third faction he had to deal with was the tribe of Judah, his own home tribe, because that was where Absalom went. He went to Hebron, David's capital in the tribe of Judah, before he went to Jerusalem as the capital of the nation of Israel. Absalom went to Hebron when he began the revolt, and he had the Judeans behind him, David's own tribe, and David needed to settle that problem and get those dissidents and defectors back onto his team. So, the tribe of Israel itself was sorely divided, and you may recall, Absalom had made Amasa his commander-in-chief. And Amasa was from Judah, and there were many who would have followed under Amasa. Probably Amasa could have made himself king over Judah. David had to deal with these dynamics at this time. He had to get face to face with the reality. And here's where David does something very clever. And in our reading of this text, you might have thought that was very unfair. David sends a message to Amasa, Absalom's commander-in-chief, saying, I offer you the position in my army of being my commander-in-chief. Immediately you should be asking, what about Joab? And we'll come to that shortly. But David, in a sense, it's extremely unfair to Joab, but he sends a message to Judah, to Amasa, come and be my commander-in-chief. I guarantee the safety of your life, and you will be my commander-in-chief. And it works like a charm. Amasa comes, and Judah is wooed over back to David, and here's a question then. Why does David do this, offer Amasa this position in place of Joab? Two reasons. One, now recall, it was Joab who thrust the three darts through the heart of Absalom. And we have no record that David said anything to Joab. So that there could have been a lot of anger in the father's heart against Joab, but yet Joab being so strong and powerful and well-respected and known and even respected by the army, he could not take direct reprisals, so okay, I cut you out of your position, and I bring another man in. One good reason. Secondly, again, it could have been a very wise and shrewd political move by David if he were going to forgive Amasa, the one who backed his son, rebellious son Absalom, to the hilt. Then he was giving a message to the whole tribe of Judah, and even those in Israel who backed Absalom, that he was not going to take any reprisals against anybody who sided with his son Absalom against him. So two good reasons why, perhaps, he made this move. So to show that David was planning no revenge against any of Absalom's supporters. And as I said, the result was that Judah responded warmly, and in a sense, David is showing a big heart. A lot of forgiveness here. And the point that we could draw is that forgiveness is an important Christian virtue and a wise and shrewd act of leadership. Now, there are times, we discussed this some weeks ago, when forgiveness is a cop-out for weakness because the leader does not want to face the situation and call so-and-so on the carpet. But at certain times, forgiveness in the right time, well applied, is a wise and shrewd act of leadership. Let's move on to the second half of chapter 19, verses 16 through 40. We'll deal with 41 through 43 with the next chapter. So chapter 19, verses 16 through 40. And here there are two levels of interest. There's the personal angle and the tribal angle. The personal angle covers four individuals: Shimei, Mephibosheth, Ziba, and Barzillai. Now, Shimei, we recall from the last few chapters, was the man, the Benjaminite, who, when David was leaving Jerusalem with his soldiers to Absalom and his army to come and take over, remember, Shimei came and he cast dirt and stones at David and his men, and he cursed them. Now David's come back to power. Shimei is one of the first, before the tribe of Judah, before David's home tribe come, Shimei is one of the first with 1,000 Benjaminites, along with Ziba and Ziba's sons and servants, who come and they ferry David's army and men across the Jordan. Come home, come home. Shimei, of course, is doing everything he can to save his crummy little neck, because he knows his head will roll. Recall, when he was cursing David, Abishai, one of the three sons of Zeruiah, Joab, Abishai, Asahel. Asahel was slain by Abner. But these three were like the sons of thunder. And Abishai told David, "Why does my Lord allow that dead dog to curse you? Give me the wood, I'll take his head off with one stroke." And David said, "Let him be. Maybe the Lord sent him. Who am I to argue as part of my punishment for my sins in the past?" And here comes Shimei, ferrying David's troops across. And then the record says that when he got David in the boat, he fell down before him and said, "My Lord, remember me, forgive me for my terrible sin. I'm not worthy to live." He's begging for his life. And again Abishai says, "Let me finish him off." But David says, "This is a time to celebrate victory." Again, shrewd move. In all probability, all of us will agree he deserved to die. But David said, "Let him live." David was to rebuild people. The kingdom just didn't come back into David's lap. There were so many dissidents now. In fact, after this, there was another short revolt we'll cover. But David had to be wise and shrewd. He said, "Let him live. I'd rather have 1,000 men, which he has on my side, than against me." So Shimei was one. I like this thought. David suppressed his own heart's feelings about Shimei. The Bible and the writer of this episode only tells us what David said and did for Shimei. He doesn't tell us what David felt and thought. You heard that. Many times we are in a similar situation, either as a boss with employees or employees with a boss. We can hear what they are saying and doing, but we are not sure what they are thinking and feeling. And we know from the record, 1 Kings chapter 2 verse 8 tells us this. In his dying breath, David is talking to his son Solomon. And the last person he mentions to Solomon is, "Remember Shimei." Now that's one-on-one with his son Solomon. How he cursed your father. And David gave his word to Shimei, "You will live." At least under his regime. And he tells Solomon, "My son, you're wise. You know what to do. You take care of him. For what he did to your father and how he cursed me." And that's a good interplay between employees and leaders. We know what David said and did. But we do not know at this time how he felt and what he thought. So much for Shimei. Next was Mephibosheth. He was Jonathan's son, the one who was lame in his feet, who David heard that Mephibosheth was wanting to take the throne over after David was leaving from Absalom, leaving Jerusalem. But that was a lie perpetrated by Ziba, Mephibosheth's servant. When David meets Mephibosheth, he says, "Why didn't you come with me when I left Jerusalem?" And Mephibosheth, apparently this is the truth, where he had not shaved his beard, nor changed his clothes, nor done anything from the day that David left. In mourning, so to speak. And Mephibosheth says, "My lord, Ziba, the servant, lied to you. I told him to saddle me a donkey so I could come with you, but instead he went away and left me there, and he told you this." And again, wisdom. David has to make a split decision. What do I do? Remember when Ziba lied to David, David told Ziba, "Everything that Mephibosheth owns, his whole estate is yours." And now David has to handle the situation. Ziba's not right there. He says, "Okay, well, you go halves. Ziba keeps half of it and you take half of it." So he He doesn't appear to readily believe the whole story of Mephibosheth, but he's still forgiving. He's rebuilding the kingdom, folks. Okay, I forgive you, you take half. Why did he allow Ziba to keep half the kingdom? Suppose he did believe Mephibosheth's story. The fact remains that when David was leaving Jerusalem, Ziba still came, regardless of what Ziba's motives were. Ziba was taking a calculated risk or a gamble that David would probably come back, and he still came with provision for David's army. So you keep half the kingdom, half of the estate of Mephibosheth for that. So he keeps them all as friends and loses none as enemies. So much for Mephibosheth. And it seems here that David's governing principle now was that there would be no reprisals against anyone. Very wise moves. And finally, Barzillai. It was Shobai, Machir. Remember, Machir was the one who kept Mephibosheth when he was a boy on up, till David brought him to the palace. Shobai, Machir, and Barzillai, these three men, when David went to Mahanaim and made his capital after leaving Jerusalem, these were the three who brought donkeys loaded with produce and food and provision for David and his whole army. And of the three, Barzillai comes to the fore. This is the type of true friend, loyal, faithful, committed, dedicated, dependable, refreshing. Philemon, only one chapter, verse 7b, has one of the highest compliments I have seen in Scripture ever paid to any believer. And for a time, I want us to take a break, and I know so many things that we can study are negative, but there are some very positive things. And Paul is writing the epistle to Philemon, the master of the slave, Onesimus, who ran away and got saved under Paul. That's a beautiful study, that one chapter, that one book. But Paul says this to Philemon. And Philemon is a wealthy man, like a businessman, like a leader in today's community. And Paul writes and says, "For the bowels or the heart of the saints are refreshed by thee, brother." You are so loved, so respected in the community, says the Apostle Paul. And if we stop to think, yes, there are persons in your life, in my life, who have been like that to us. You think of certain names, and it brings a smile to your face. Maybe brings a tear to your eye for the way they stood by you through thick and thin when you were down and out. "For the bowels of the saints are refreshed by thee, brother." Such a man was Barzillai. And at this point, he was 80 years old. And David says, "Barzillai, step into my ferry. Come along to Jerusalem with me. I'll treat you like a king in my palace for your goodness to me when I needed it." And Barzillai says, "My lord, I'm 80 years old. I can't really relish the venison meat that you eat or the wine that you drink. That time for me is over. Or enjoy the music that the young men and maidens sing. Nevertheless, here's Chimham." We don't know if Chimham was a relative or a nephew or one of the sons of Barzillai. And he was perhaps to Barzillai what Barzillai was to David. But being a younger man, Barzillai says, "Give the blessing you would have given me to young Chimham." Even in that, Barzillai transfers the blessing. This struck me. There's a whole message on Barzillai. And I like those thoughts where you take a totally unknown person to the normal person. So he says, "You give the blessing you would have given me to Chimham. Let me go back. I shall die before long, and I desire to be buried beside my parents in my hometown." And so that's the way Barzillai fades off the scene. But a friend who enriches life, loyal, faithful, committed, dedicated, dependable, refreshing. Here's an interesting thought. Shimei, who cursed David, Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, and Ziba, Mephibosheth's servant, who had half the estate, were all three Benjaminites. The dynamic between Judah and Benjamin must have been very delicate. Now understand this, of all the 12 tribes, the southernmost is Judah, and a very large tribe land-wise too. Right above it is Benjamin. But Benjamin was the royal tribe. They were the tribe of Saul. He was a Benjaminite. And Ishbosheth, his son, who was king of the northern kingdom before he was slain by two of his, Rechab and Baana, his name came back, two of his army captains. So Benjamin was the royal tribe, which produced the first two kings of Israel, well, from Saul to Ishbosheth for a while. And here was Judah, the next royal tribe. And of all the 12 tribes, these two would have had a certain dynamic between them as to who is really going to be the seat of power in the nation of Israel. And David, in one stroke, in one passage, is looking favorably upon all these three Benjaminites. And you find that that turns to his favor tremendously. In fact, barely, just over one generation later, after David comes Solomon. After Solomon was his son Rehoboam, who was a wicked, unjust, ungodly young man. And while Rehoboam ruled the southern kingdom of Judah, Jeroboam was chosen out of the very powerful tribe of Ephraim. The whole book of Hosea is written to Ephraim, as if Ephraim was Israel. Jeroboam comes out of Ephraim and rules the northern kingdom. But when that division takes place for many, many generations, one other tribe stays with Judah, and that is Benjamin. And I believe, or scholars look at it too, that this shrewd, wise strategy of David in forgiving these Benjaminites has part to play, because Benjamin then gets so integrally hooked up with Judah. When the division takes place, it's the northern ten, and the southern kingdom is Judah and Benjamin. So, that much for these three men, Shimei, Mephibosheth, and Ziba. All three Benjaminites. And as to close out that thought, here's an interesting point. I have this in your sheets too. It is impossible to put back the clock in life. Things were never going to be as easy for David again. He had been sent out because he trusted his son Absalom too much, etc., etc. Now make this application in our lives. We make mistakes, but God can restore. It is impossible to put back the clock in life, but with God's help, care, and effort on our part, mistakes are not beyond all remedy or repair. Now David had to rebuild the kingdom, see? It is always right to take a positive attitude. Always. I don't care what you've been through, how deep you've gone. It is always right to take a positive attitude, to make a fresh start, even if the new will never be as splendid as the old. Even if the new will never be as splendid as the old. Let's move on to the last four verses of chapter 19. That's chapter 19, verses 41 through 43, and chapter 20, verses 1 through 10. At the time that David is ferried over the Jordan into Jerusalem by the tribe of Judah, there's a heated verbal quarrel between Judah and Israel, the tribe of Judah and the northern ten tribes. And here's an example of how future events cast their shadows beforehand. This is indicative. There's animosity between the northern ten tribes and Judah here, and we see that Benjamin sides with Judah. And it's casting a shadow beforehand of the division of the nation in generations to come. So there were some heated words. The argument is really the northern tribe of Israel says, why didn't you call us so we could also help in ferrying King David across with his army? And Judah says, hey, he's our tribesman. He's from our home, our family. And he didn't pay us for this. We didn't receive bread or food from him. We did it from our own hearts. And so what's wrong? And it says that the words of the men of Judah were more fierce and rough than the words of the men of Israel. And that ended the argument for the time being. And at this point, some of these northern ten tribes, they said, we have 10 parts in him. You are 2 parts, we are 10 parts of Israel. You should have given us the opportunity. And at this point, there's a man named Sheba. Now, not Shimei. He's the man who cursed David, and David said, I'll spare your life later on. A man named Sheba, who cashes in on this opportunity of the strife between Israel and Judah, and says, come on, men of Israel, we have no part in David, follow me. And he wants to make himself king of the northern tribes of Israel. And so we will now study briefly Sheba's revolt. He is a Benjaminite. Sheba is a Benjaminite. He tries to cash in on the situation and lead a new revolt against David. This revolt seemed very dangerous, but we find later it fizzles out. In fact, evidently Judah's position, as I mentioned, had caused some resentment with the other tribes, I mentioned earlier that Ephraim later becomes very powerful. Ephraim is not mentioned here, but it takes on a major role as Jeroboam becomes king out of Ephraim. And so these northern tribes follow off under Sheba. It seems initially that all of the northern 10 tribes with Benjamin at this point follow Sheba, but later on it fizzles out. If you read the story, initially all of Israel goes, but then he goes to the northern, northeastern frontier, town of Abel of Beth-Maacah, and there he makes a stand. And David, as you follow the story, David sends out his army against him, and finally, Sheba is not left with all of Israel. He's not even left with his tribe of Benjamin. He's only left with his own clansmen, community people, Bichri, the Bichrites, who are with him making a stand. Now, if you would have read the story before, let me get into some thoughts about this. So Sheba goes there, and he makes a stand. Here's a thought, too. Why is it that David was somehow able to hold together the northern nation of Israel, even though when he came back, he used some shrewd politics, and his in future generations, I mentioned under, after Solomon was Rehoboam, that those successors couldn't do that. And there's a few thoughts here I'll give you before we come to the end of Sheba's revolt. One, theologically, it was God's will that David would be king over united Israel. Secondly, David did have leadership talents that his successors lacked. When you read the accounts of Rehoboam, he certainly didn't have the wisdom or tact of David. Thirdly, David exercised wisdom and political skill in obedience to God. You watch that every time David made a move, though he was king, it says that he sought the Lord. The Living Bible says it this way. Now, leaders, let's hear this. The Living Bible says, when David was faced with a decision, he spent much time in prayer over a matter. He spent much time in prayer over the matter. Lord, what should we do? So thirdly, as I said, he exercised wisdom and political skill in obedience to God. And fourthly, David avoided showing any favoritism to his home tribe of Judah. He avoided showing favoritism to the home tribe of Judah. And a good, true leader must be scrupulously fair to all his citizens. A government must be scrupulously fair to all its citizens, regardless of race, color, tribe, tongue. A good government must be scrupulously fair to all its citizens. And David did not show favoritism to Judah. Here's a thought about the appointment of Amasa. Let's quickly run through that story. David did appoint Amasa as his commander-in-chief in place of Joab. And now Sheba revolts. David says, Amasa, I give you 3 days. Quick, rustle up my army, and then I want to send you out against Sheba, who has revolted and gone to the north of Israel. Amasa takes more than 3 days. David calls Abishai. He doesn't call Joab. He's put Amasa in place of Joab. What's the politicking here for? Okay, so he calls Joab's brother Abishai, who, by the way, was a very mighty warrior. Later on, we read that in one incident, Abishai slew 300 Philistines. He was a mighty warrior. Abishai, you go and take care of Sheba and his revolt. If I keep waiting for Amasa in his ineffectiveness, he will do us more harm than my son Absalom did when he revolted. Abishai, you go. Now, what do you think Abishai does? He gets the army together with his brother Joab, who is not officially commander-in-chief. And they both go to meet Sheba and finish him off. En route, they meet Amasa. Joab goes to give him a hug, and it's Amasa's last hug. While he puts his arm around him, it says Joab caught him by the beard and his left hand drove the knife through Amasa. So, you see, David's politicking, I mean, the world is the same all over, folks. People are the same all over. In today's world, we don't stick knives in people, literally. Okay? But it still happens, depending on who's playing the pawns on the checkerboard in which situation. Now, watch what happens at this point. About Amasa. David's appointment of Amasa as commander-in-chief was to pacify Judah for siding Absalom in the revolt. Why did this appointment fail? I just described to you how Amasa was killed. Why did that appointment fail? One, because of Amasa's inefficiency. David gave him 3 days to get the army together. He couldn't do it. So it was Amasa's inefficiency. And secondly, I shared with you how he died, who killed him, Joab. There was Joab's violent determination to retrieve his lost position. So Joab didn't have the chance to talk to the king about it. He was going to work on it himself. And he personally finished off Amasa. And let's consider this thought, though, about Joab. No matter what sins Joab had committed in the past, his loyalty to David, as far as the record shows, never wavered. Even though David cut him out of being his commander-in-chief, Joab was still loyal to David till the very end. So we give him a lot of credit for that. And David needed a powerful man like Joab. And that's a good thought too, because even the greatest leaders are largely dependent on men who are available to support them. Let's move on to chapter 20, the same chapter, moving from verse 10b on to the end to verse 26. And here we'll see the end of Sheba's revolt. So Sheba, we said, is in the town of Abel of Beth-Maacah in the northeastern frontier of Israel. Now, here's a comparative thought. Absalom's revolt was crushed in a large-scale battle with many soldiers being killed and a lot of bloodshed. But Sheba's revolt, as we shall see, collapsed with the minimum bloodshed. At the start, we find that all of Israel followed Sheba, but at the end, only his clansmen of Bichri are left. Now, we mentioned Abel of Beth-Maacah is a town in the northeastern frontier, and Sheba makes a stand, and so Joab and Abishai, who are sent by David, Abishai was, he went with Joab, they have to make a siege. The town of Abel of Beth-Maacah has a big fortified wall, and here's Joab and Abishai now with the, it says that they built a mound up on one side of the wall, and they were starting to batter down and to break through, and one, it says, wise woman, literally wise, sagacious lady, had an idea. And this whole story about the encounter between the wise lady and Joab is a very interesting study on wisdom. So let's focus in on wisdom for this story now. Joab is about to breach the walls, and this lady can see, in fact, the rest of the inhabitants can tell, that because of Sheba and his men being in their city, they're going to be devastated, their wall will be broken down, their sons and their husbands will be killed, and so this woman says, I have a plan, let me work it out. And here's what she does. She comes up and she gets an opportunity to talk to David and she says, to Joab, and she says, are you Joab? He says, yes, I am. And she works something out. She says, why should we as a town, Abel of Beth-Maacah, have been known for our wisdom through the years? Why should a town with such a good reputation suffer for one man coming and taking refuge here, Sheba? And Joab says, oh no, I don't want to make you suffer and your sons and your husbands and your fathers. All I want is one man, Sheba. You give him to me and we'll let you go. She says, okay, give me 24 hours. Next day, she has them toss Sheba's head over the wall of the city. And I said, this whole story is a study in wisdom. Let's look at this. This wise lady, and it's interesting, it's a woman that God uses to bring salvation into the whole city. This wise woman meets with Joab. And as I mentioned a little earlier, it's interesting to note that a city noted for its wisdom ought not to come to such a bad end. And this story is a picture of wisdom in action. Actually, I really believe when you study this too, that there's no separating actions from the word wisdom. You can separate action from the word knowledge, but not from the word wisdom. Now watch this. Wisdom, one definition, is the timely and appropriate application of knowledge. Timely and appropriate application of knowledge. First step of the woman. She saw the problem realistically. She stood to lose her husband and sons and whoever. She saw the problem realistically. She knew Joab's army was stronger. Second, she did something about it. She did not wait for somebody else to take the initiative. She took the initiative herself, this woman, yes. Thirdly, She argued her case with Joab. She challenged the rightness of his actions. Is it right for you to come and slay all our people for the sake of one man? And then she worked out and reached a compromise. And fourthly, as I mentioned earlier, they tossed the head over the wall the next day. Fourthly, she took steps to fulfill the terms agreed upon. She acted. She took steps to fulfill the terms agreed upon. Her wisdom was a combination of intelligent insight and action. And the Old Testament rarely separates the intelligent from the pragmatic. In so many cases in the Old Testament, she had the intelligent insight, but she was pragmatic, she was practical, she acted it out, she fulfilled the terms of the agreement. And the Bible, as a secondary thought, has no time for armchair philosophers. It's not enough, and here we see a clear distinction between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge was the insight. She saw this was a more powerful army. She knew David was to be the king. Who was this upstart coming in here, endangering her family and her whole town? That's knowledge. But she acted upon it. Wisdom is knowledge and insight in action at the appropriate time. And in verse 19b, the woman refers to her town of Israel, get this phrase, as the inheritance of the Lord. Why should Joab come in and slay the inheritance of the Lord? Remember, that was the same term that David used to King Saul when Saul was pursuing David, and David said, "My Lord, you are making me leave the coasts of Israel to live in the land of the Philistines. You are making me forsake the inheritance of the Lord." God's people, we are the inheritance of the Lord. He's waiting for us, not for anything else.
Please flip the tape over for the continuation on this series of 2 Samuel chapters 19, 20, and 21, as also chapter 23, verses 8 through 39. Thank you.
Then chapter 21, verses 1 through 14, first half. Here we see the fate of Saul's family, and let me make an apology beforehand. This is one of the saddest, most repelling stories you can read in the Old Testament. And so strengthen yourselves if you are of a softer demeanor, and let's move through it anyway. This is the fate of Saul's family. And to our thinking, this story here is strange and repelling, where seven innocent men are executed with David's permission and authority. And even their bodies, their corpses are dishonored for a while. And I'm sure that even commentators are certain that many, many people would have laid the blame for this fully upon David. Very quickly, here's what happens. The Gibeonites in Joshua chapter 9, when God had sent them, remember Moses dies, but God sends the children of Israel into Canaan under Joshua, and the orders were slay everybody, don't spare anyone, you're going to have problems if you do. And they did so, except the Gibeonites somehow perceived that these were God's people. They'd heard about the tremendous things in Egypt and how God had given them victory over other nations, and so they came to make a league, a plan, a treaty. And they disguised themselves, like with worn clothes and stale bread. You might recall that story. And they said, "We come from afar, make a league with us that we can be your servants." And they did so. One mistake of Joshua's was that he did not consult the oracle of God. But he felt sorry, he saw the worn clothes, and he fell for the trap. And he made a league with them that they would be able to serve them, and that the children of Israel would not slay them. Now that's the group of people we're talking about. At this time in David's rule, there's a famine for 3 years. And again, the Living Bible said, David spent much time praying about it. Lord, why has this famine come upon the nation? And through the oracle of God, by checking with the priests, perhaps the Urim and Tumim, David gets the message back that it's because of the mischief that King Saul did to the Gibeonites. Apparently, when Saul was in power, he attacked the Gibeonites and slew them. One commentator says, why did Saul do that anyway? He knew about this long-standing, time-honored league, even though it was deception. They made the league, and they stood by it. But Saul broke the league, probably in his overly nationalistic zeal. He wanted to wipe out everybody who was an Israelite. Well, the Germans tried the same thing in the Second World War, right, with the Jews, etc. And Saul, in his nationalistic zeal, tried to wipe these people out, and he slew many, many Gibeonites. And this is the response David gets. That's why this famine has come upon the land. Go to the Gibeonites and make things right. And when he goes to them, then he says, tell me what I can do for you to make up for the error of Saul when he attacked your people innocently and slew them. And they could have, there's some interesting thoughts here, legally, according to Israelite law at that time, remember this, at that time, being that they were foreigners, they had no legal rights to any recompense from the Israelites. Yes, the only deal was they wouldn't kill them, which the Israelites broke, so they want to make amends. But legally, they had no opportunity for redress for the crimes against them. But David, because he spent much time praying about it, felt that morally, though not legally, morally, the nation of Israel owed something to the Gibeonites. And he probably expected they would have asked for some economic aid to make up for the devastation they suffered at Saul's hands. And they had, it was theirs for the asking. But, like Shylock, you know, in The Merchant of Venice by Shakespeare, they demanded their pound of flesh. And instead of financial returns, they said, give us seven of Saul's sons. Saul is dead. We can't get back at him. He slew our sons, our fathers, and our husbands. Give us seven of his sons, and we will hang them before the Lord. What was David to do now? And so he takes two of one of Saul's wives' sons and five of another, and he hands them over to the Gibeonites, and they hang them. I'm not clear. One version says hang. The other one says that they impaled them. Nevertheless, we'll cut the gory details out. They slew those seven sons, and believe it or not, it started to rain after they were slain. There was famine for 3 years. That's what led up to all these events. Quite some interesting stories in here. Started to rain. And Rizpah, the mother of two of the seven sons, just for your thoughts, Rizpah was the concubine of Saul, whom Abner went into when Ishbosheth was king, and Ishbosheth challenged him, and they had an argument and fell out, and then Abner joined forces with David, and then Joab slew Abner, and the story goes on. Rizpah was that concubine, but it was two of her sons through Saul that were slain. She stayed outdoors through the day and night, covered the corpses, because her sons' bodies were being dishonored. Finally, David got the news, even when it began to rain, the bodies would have started rotting. And he then finally says, give those bones an honorable burial. He sends a message to the men of Jabesh Gilead. If you remember, they were the ones who recovered Saul and Jonathan's corpses from Bethshan, which was the place where the Philistines made a mockery of their bodies. He said, send also Saul and Jonathan's bones, and we will give all of them, being in the family of Saul, an honorable burial. So much for the story. Here are some thoughts about it. We said many in Israel would have fully blasted David with the blame for this repelling incident. Some thoughts. We do need to understand, though, that David's hand was forced by certain things. One, the circumstances of the famine. Second, by guidance of the oracle, he would have asked of the Urim and Thummim. And third, by the legal and legitimate demands of the Gibeonites. Even though I mentioned they had no legal rights, morally they owed it to them, some recompense. I've covered how the Gibeonites made the deceitful league with the background. And covered how Saul probably killed and attacked the Gibeonites out of an overly nationalistic zeal. Two things to be said perhaps in David's favor after this incident. Of the seven sons of Saul, you notice he did not take Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, who was from his family. So he did protect Mephibosheth, and he kept his word to Mephibosheth. He ate at the king's table till he died. And secondly, as I recounted a little earlier, David did finally give the dead men an honorable burial after the rain fell. In other words, Lord, it's a terrible thing that happened. I'm sorry I was caught up in all of this. I tried to do right, and here's what happened. But I thank you for answering prayer and sending us the rain again. The famine is over. It is Some commentators have used the term second-class citizen for the Gibeonites. And I put myself in this place to give you an interesting thought, with perhaps a humorous twinge. One of my community, seated before the Australian Consulate General, years ago when I was still a teenager, was asked by the Consulate General, who of course had the cause in his hand, here was a poor guy from a poor country, India, a third world country. The Consulate General said to this young man, why would you want to leave your country to come to Australia and live as a second-class citizen? Before this young man could even get to the country, the big boss is telling him, you come to our country, you'll be treated like second-class, man. And so this young man replied, sir, I'd rather be a second-class citizen in a first-class country than be a first-class citizen in a third-world country. And maybe that's why I'm here today. But I don't feel that way. I watch it in Milan. Not at all, okay? Well, that was an interesting and an intelligent answer by an indomitable spirit. And that's what is part of the making of a man or a woman. You know, I am who I am in Jesus Christ. Not where I am or what the circumstances. Maybe we are above those circumstances. And when people pick that up, then they start to rub shoulders with you and they love you and respect you. And you can be another Ittai, a Philistine highly honored by David and his army. So, chapter 21, the second half, verses 15 through 22, and the section of chapter 23, 8 through 39, with all those names, this isn't it. And here we have an account of David and his soldiers. Both these passages, the second half of chapter 21 and 8 through 39 of chapter 23, both these passages are from an earlier period of David's reign. We'll prove that to you very simply and quickly. In these lists are listed the names of David's mighty men. One of them, for example, is Asahel. He was one of the three sons of Zeruiah, Joab, Abishai, Asahel. Asahel was already dead, folk. He was the one who was fleet of foot, who was pursuing Abner. Abner says that, you Asahel, get away from me, stop chasing me. He says, no, I won't. And so with the butt end of a spear, he stabs him back, and Asahel is killed with the spear back end going through his body. Another name, the last verse, chapter 23, verse 39, the last name of David's mighty men is Uriah the Hittite, the husband of Bathsheba. Uriah was, well, indirectly killed by David in the battlefield under Joab with David's instructions. So we can tell, now remember we said this is not the author of these two books of Samuel. He just put these together. And so some of these passages are certainly not in chronological order. That's why we took these two passages together. Also, there's a reference in chapter 21 where it says when David was encamped, well, the Philistines came and encamped against David in Rephaim. That was when the battle, when Saul and Jonathan were just killed. The Philistines were in full force. They inhabited the cities. The children of Israel left. David wasn't hiding here, and they came to track David down. So that was way back. It's in 2 Samuel chapter 5. And so these lists of names really should come up around there. Also, when you begin an army, that's when you get all these big, mighty warriors around you. So, with that understanding that both these passages are from an earlier period of David's reign, let's pursue this. David apparently had an elite group of soldiers. And of these 37 altogether, three of them were extraordinary men. We call them the Invincibles or the Invincible Three. The one of them, I'm not going to pronounce his name because it's too long. It begins with J. Maybe we'll have a treat. I'll try that one. This would be in chapter 23. His name is Josheb-Basibet, the Tachmonite. Verse 8. These be the names of the mighty men whom David had. The Tachmonite in the King James, other versions give you his name, Josheb-Basibet, the Tachmonite. It says, he, the second half of verse 8, lifted up his spear against 800 whom he slew at one time. I mentioned Abishai, slew 300. Of these three, one of these three, it says that he kept slaying the enemy, and kept slaying the enemy, and kept slaying the enemy, till his arm grew weary and he put it down.
And those were among the top three. This guy whom I just mentioned was one of them. Verse 9 is an interesting name here. After him was Eliezer, the son of Dodo. How do you like to have a father with a name like that? My father's a Dodo. All right. But anyway, that's in verse 9 of that chapter. So the top three invincible men of David's, they were the elite three, extraordinarily strong, and the other 34, actually David is one of them, and you have these three invincibles, that makes four. You had the three sons of Zeruiah, Joab, Abishai, and Asahel, that made seven, and there were 30 others. So 30 mighty men, three brothers, sons of Zeruiah, three invincibles, and David makes 37. So if you get confused sometimes when people say there were 30 men, there were 37, that's exactly how you get 37. 30 mighty men, three sons of Zeruiah, three invincibles, and David, 37. Now, with these men, well, I already covered the first three. Even giant Philistines, giant-sized Philistines could not match them. This elite unit of 30 or so, or crack regiment, you could call them, were distinguished by their courage, strength, ability, and endurance. And they were very loyal and devoted to David. In fact, we see how they fought beside David and even prevented him from endangering his own life. In chapter 21, I want us to read two verses there, 16 and 17. One time in battle, what's this incident where David almost got killed? Chapter 21, verse 16, and Ishbi-Benob, who was one of the sons of the giant, the weight of his spear weighed 300 shekels of brass in weight. He was girded with a new sword. He thought to slay David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, succored him and smote the Philistine. He came to David's help and killed the Philistine. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, you shall go no more out with us to battle, that you quench not the light of Israel. David, you're getting older. We don't want to hurt your feelings. But you, we esteem you, we value you as our king. No more are you going to go out in battle with us. Lest you quench the light of Israel. Some versions call him the lamp of Israel. They valued him so highly. If he were to die, it would have been like they would have been kept, so to speak, in darkness, leaderless and rudderless. If he were to die, there would have been, so to speak, in darkness, leaderless and rudderless. A quick thought from the last 10 days. I was talking with the pastor of Hess Mennonite Church, who just got back from Israel, and he shared about his Jewish guide who was so... He said, they don't care if you're American or anything. They are number one. You come afterwards. They are taught that from the time they're children. They are the invincibles. And they are quick to say, it's because of God in our sight. Nobody can beat us. I said, do you know, he said, the guide was telling us. This refers to David going into battle here. Why? We always win. In the 67 war, they beat Syria, Jordan, Egypt at the same time. Do you know why we always win? And he said, most of the tourists are Americans. He said, because all of the countries, including the United States, their generals and their colonels and their majors sit back in their top brass offices and send the soldiers out to fight. In Israel, our generals lead the troops into battle. We always win. We lead them into battle. That's why statistics show that in Israel, a high percentage of generals and colonels are dead, even though their loss is very minimal compared to the other nations. And David had the same attitude that carried down. As king, even at that age, he was leading. The only time he didn't, he fell into trouble. But he knew what was the right thing. He was leading his troops into battle. And I thought, wow, you would be scared to want a promotion in Israel. If you think that's true, I don't want to be a general. I'd be the first one to get hit. But maybe that's why they win. Because only the strongest, the toughest, and the best will drive and rise to that position. No wonder they're the invincibles. And they have God, no question. And so they say, you are the lamp and the light of Israel. No more will you go out to battle. We see the loyalty and commitment to David. They protected him. Abishai, he has saved his life. And now they prevent him from endangering his life anymore in the future. And chapter 23. In the other list, there's one other passage I want us to read from verses 14 through 17. One little interesting incident. And David was then in a hold or in a cave, and the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. Now this is not now, this is earlier in his reign. Remember, this passage is not in chronological order. And David longed for and said, "Oh, that one would give me drink of the water from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." And now the Philistines were in charge there. And the three mighty men, the invincibles, break through the host of the Philistines and drew water out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate and took it and brought it to David. Nevertheless, he would not drink, but poured it to the Lord and said, "Be it far from me, O Lord, that I should do this. Is not this the blood of men that went in jeopardy of their lives?" So he would not drink it, but poured it out as a libation or a drink offering, so to speak, unto the Lord. But you can just picture these three powerful men. And the first guy could have handled 800 at one stretch. They were flaying their way through there, and probably two of them on either side warding off the third one, getting the water, coming back. It's no surprise. It's not a tall story, folk. Just a few years ago, you read the book 90 Minutes at Entebbe, the airport of Uganda, East Africa, where there were so many Jews being held hostage, and the Israeli Air Force, what Jimmy Carter and the United States could not do for the American hostages, which is a fact, don't be offended, the Israelis did, and they rescued their hostages right from Entebbe Airport in Uganda. There's a book, in 90 minutes time, they had a man driving a car who looked like Idi Amin, who was then insane, he's still insane, dictator of Uganda, and they faked it in, landed their plane in Uganda's airport, took off with their hostages, not one dead. It's not a dull story. And that happened in our generation less than a decade ago. Or maybe the time is passing on. Maybe it was about 12 years ago. And so these three men risked their lives. David says, "I can't drink that water." Yes, they are invincible because God is on their side. And as far as the loyalty of these men, I mentioned they were loyal to David. There was a great bond of loyalty between them and their leader, even though verse 39 of chapter 23, the mention of Uriah's name shows that David's loyalty to them was not necessarily 100%. And that's a challenging thought for us leaders. And the thought about leadership, great leadership is of little value without loyal followers. I was going to ask us the question, why is Israel's army so tough? But you can see I got ahead of myself. Their generals and colonels lead the troops in the battle. In verse 17b of chapter 21, we read that they called David's own men called him the lamp of Israel. They valued the king so much, without him, I said, they'd be in darkness, leaderless, and rudderless. Today, here's a social thought. Today, there seems to be so much of stress on all men being equal, equality of men, women, and yes, that's true to a point. But folk, let's not be trapped into, there's a danger there of undervaluing special talents that God has given individuals. There's certain things, gifts my wife has that I don't, or that are nowhere near as developed in me, and I would assume vice versa for all of us. And let's not get into the trap of undermining the special talents that God has given individuals, and he has chosen and he has anointed certain persons to be leaders. And we need to recognize that because of the two options of cynicism and loyalty. Cynicism is the much easier option. And too often, as suspecting human beings, we tend to be more cynical than loyal. But God has called and ordained. He says, "Before you were in your mother's womb, I knew you and ordained you." And so all we need to do is recognize that, and by doing that, we are honoring God. That's it. Have a blessed week.